This is FUV Live Sessions, a podcast brought to you by WFUV in New York City. Each week, we talk to artists in our Bronx studio or at venues around the city, and we listen to them play a live set. You'll get to hear the songs and learn about the artist or band. Episodes drop every Monday wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on all the latest episodes and to find your next favorite artist or band. And of course, if you like what you hear, please make sure that you rate and review the show so other music lovers can find it. This is FUV Live Sessions with Charlie Crockett. I'm Megan Suma, and I'm here with host Alisa Ali at WFUV. Alisa, I have to admit, I'm an equal opportunity genre lover when it comes to music, but country music is probably the thing you'll find the least of on my listened to charts. But I love Charlie Crockett, and you guys talk about it a little bit in the interview. His music is imbued with so many other flavors, but this new album is really good.
Yeah. And you know what? I have to say, same with me. Like, I love all genres of music, but country is kind of not the top. However, I love Charlie Crockett's music. And I will also say that there's no doubt his music is country music, but there are so many layers and flavors that are folded into the mix. It's an unpredictable mix, and it really is a full sound. And it's also like a really full picture, lyrically speaking. And he takes you on this journey. They're really vivid stories that he weaves. And you get lost in these stories, and you get lost in these sounds. And that's why, you know, this album is just so compelling. And it's the second in a trilogy that he's calling the Sagebrush Trilogy, the last album, which I believe we brought him in for.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Lonesome Drifter. So you can check the WFUV archives for that FUV live session. But this record, I think, even it expands on that last album and brings in more musical styles and flavors. And it is really such a wonderful, wonderful. And it's like his 15th or 16th record.
Yeah.
So like this guy, he's not a new kid on the block.
No.
At all. It's not his first time at the rodeo.
No.
But the rodeo just keeps getting more exciting, more and more exciting.
Yeah, it does. And I will just say to our listeners out there, if you love an existential, philosophical rumination, this interview is it. He's a really smart, interesting guy. So let's get into it. What is the first song that we're going to hear Charlie play?
This is actually one of my favorite songs from the record, which he actually co-wrote with Shooter Jennings, who co-produced this record as well as the last record. And I assume we'll produce the next record. It's called Tennessee Quick Cash here on WFUV.
Well, I'm hard to understand, and I can't work for the man. I earn my living playing one-night shows on the long and winding road. I don't care about where it goes, but every now and again we come to Tennessee. The memory, it stays with me. I went on before the committee. They put me up so late, the doggone joint was closed. But before they cut out the light on number 82 that night, a woman locking the door gave me good advice. If you need some money fast, I'd hit the Tennessee quick cash. I know what you're about to say about their predatory ways, but brother, least they let you know it right up front. 'Cause if you take that ride downtown where them rounders hang around, you'll find anything in the world except a square deal. If you need some money fast, just hit the Tennessee quick cash. this way for years. I cry alligator tears. Something like paradise lost, I guess. Her name was Cheyenne. I thanked her as I shook her hand. And she said, honey, good luck. I think you're gonna need it. You know what, y'all? She was right. If you find your win ain't fixed, and you need some money fast, just hit the Tennessee quick cash. I'd hit the Tennessee quick cash.
A live version of Tennessee Quick Cash here on WFUV from Charlie Crockett. That is a song from the new record, Dollar a Day, which is out now. And he is with us today. And what a great version of that song. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Pleasure belongs to me, Lisa. I really appreciate y'all having me.
Now, tell me a little bit about this pawn shop in Tennessee. How many times have you been there? What have you gotten? Have you sold anything there?
Oh, well, that I'm in the music business, I've been bought and sold plenty of times. Where the song actually come from is, you know, I'd been passing through Nashville for many years at this point, and I really have been on the scenic route. I'd finally gotten this gig at a place that everybody was trying to get on at there in East Nashville. It's an American Legion Hall, post number 82. And they had a big honky-tonk night there for a number of years that was really the place to be. And when I had finally got me a spot on the bill that night, I think they had me, you know, penciled in for about 10:30. Wouldn't you know, by the time I got on, that dadgum joint was closed. Not closed, but it's probably about 1:45 a.m. Everybody's gone, except my old agent was still in the room. And all of the older women that had always kind of worked, you know, the concession stand and taking care of that American Legion Hall. I was pretty down and out when I was leaving that evening. All the lights were up and there was vacuum in the carpet. And this woman who was locking the door behind me as I walked out of there, she made a funny joke, maybe just kind of forecasting my future, being like, be careful if you go downtown here in Nashville. I think she was really talking about the business in general. And, you know, she made that comment that you'd probably get a better interest rate on your deal over at the Tennessee Quick Cash.
Yeah, the music business is rough, and I know you've seen your way around it several times. I mean, you were signed, you were dropped, you're on a major label now. It's a tough business. You've talked about it before, and you've said it's kind of like Wall Street, but except Wall Street has some rules. There's like no rules in the music business. You don't even know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, I did say that and still stand behind it. You know, I ride around in a 10 can diesel motor bus, you know, most of my life these days. And we got the old satellite TV on there, and I flip through the different channels and watch all kinds of different stuff. Sometimes in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, I really love the wild 3 a.m. infomercials. They almost should put that stuff in the MoMA or something. It, you know, it's almost art without realizing it's art. Anyway, there's this movie. I don't know if you've seen this baseball movie with Brad Pitt, Moneyball.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That first time I seen it, I wasn't paying no attention. But, you know, when they're in rotation, they just come on over and over again. And when I really start paying the mind to the movie, I'm just really enthralled by it. And at this point, I've seen it a couple hundred times probably. But I liken the modern music business to Moneyball, call it Money Guitar. It's always been a tough business. A manager, for example, in a lot of cases can exert more power than almost anybody in the business. And they are in many ways the least regulated person. And that's just life. And, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, the Nashville system because it's the part of the business that I was recognized in when I was coming in off of street corners, you know, as a transient. I had brushed up against the music business here in New York, too. But it was a little earlier version of the first time I got discovered, you know, on the R train. I think it was like 2010, 2011. And even from that time to now, which is around 15 years, it's changed a lot. Whereas, say you got a deal in Nashville in 1965. Now, you weren't making any money. You were losing money on the road. You could be number one on the country charts and still be broke. But the one thing that, say, RCA or Decca back in those days, and not just in country music and R&B, even pop records from the coast in LA and New York, the artist wasn't making a lot of money. It was hard on you. But those deals, a lot of them had real development. So Willie Nelson, for example, he didn't become a household name till The Red-Headed Stranger, which was his 18th studio album. And I think he made 14 or so for RCA before he left or was dropped or whatever you want to call it. I call it money guitar nowadays because the way that the business has changed, it's kind of like Willie Nelson said. He wrote this song called Write Your Own Songs. And he was talking all this mess at music executives. And I joke now, I say, Willie, you know, you gave them the blueprint. They figured out basically how to write their own songs in a lot of ways. And the way they hedge their bets is they put money down on a lot of young artists and, you know, usually counting on that first or second record to pop off. And if it doesn't, more than likely, they're just going to go on to the next bet. And that's kind of why I call it money guitar. So certainly that hasn't been the case for me.
Well, you're up to your like 15th or 16th record now. And I do think it's so interesting how in the past few years, since you've been popping off and getting Grammy nods and what so, people have been like, oh, this is overnight success. But you are not an overnight success. There's a lot of records under your belt and a lot of life lived, as you can tell from listening to any of your songs. And in fact, we are going to get into another song, Ain't That Right?
Here's one about a different kind of payday advance man. Blew into Austin from Denver yesterday. Got word my manager, I didn't want to stay. Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? I guess I could be a little more confused. But I play a dangerous game, they ought to call it getting used. Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? We were up above it all, flying in your plane. About the time I had that margarita, Lord, I wouldn't feel any pain. There you was in all that leather, something on your mind. I found out just what it was in the Salt Lake City lights. Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? I played them Red Rocks a couple times before, and down at Globe Hall a dozen nights or more. Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Standing on the corner in the Central Texas heat, slanging my stolen jewels in a shrink wrap CD, hanging from the ceiling of this old honky tonk saloon. Oh, a wandering boy like me, there's always more room. Ain't that right? Ain't that right? Nah, ain't that right? Ain't that right? It ain't that right, ain't that right.
Ain't That Right, a live version of the song performed by Mr. Charlie Crockett, who is here today. That song lives on the new record Dollar a Day, which is the second album that has been released this year from Charlie Crockett. It is part of a trilogy, the Sagebrush Trilogy. Can you talk to me a little bit about how this idea for a trilogy came together? I know when you made the first record, you said you kind of felt like you were stepping through a portal, or you'd opened the door to the portal. This record is now you, I guess, on the other side of the portal. Did it begin with that first record, or did you always have this idea of going for a trilogy?
Well, the first record I ever put out was called a Stolen Jewel, and I had made it after working through a whole season out there on the farms in Northern California. And after harvest, kind of after all the work was done, me and another guy, a farmhand out there, actually now is playing bass with me in the band, Kyle Madrigal, we made a record on this four-track Tascam kind of after the boss lady had left for like winter vacation after a long year of working of those cash crops. Anyway, I digress. But with Stolen Jewel, it was made so informally. And that was probably my most professional recording to that point that I ended up putting out in the spring of 2015. The first time I ever stepped into a really professional studio with a real budget really didn't come to pass until I was working on $10 Cowboy in Austin at a studio just south of the Colorado River there called Arlen Studios. It's a really great full-size studio. And I went there with Bruce Robinson, my buddy Bruce Robinson. That was the first time I'd been in a studio since getting signed up in distribution deals, you know, dealing with the music business system, that somebody had really facilitated me bringing my actual band in the studio and just kind of letting us do our thing, capture the magic rather than trying to really put their stamp on it or control it. But with Bruce, dealing with all the way the business started coming at me right after we made The Man from Waco, it was very hard to recreate that or to build on that sound when I was getting, you know, you got all these music executives and different people with different interests in the music business standing outside of your bus and every town you pull up in trying to get in your ear. Long story short, when I was still handing out CDs on street corners around Central Texas, Shooter Jennings was one of the first guys to take me out on the road and let me open up for him alongside guys like Evan Felker, the Turnpike Troubadours, BJ Barham of American Aquarium. And at the time, I didn't know that he was producing records. And or maybe he's a few years later, he started really getting into it. And in a conversation we was having about $10 Cowboy, where I'd been trying to finance this movie, always chasing the legend of Willie Nelson making movies. I spent most of my money on that record cycle on a movie that I financed myself that still hasn't come out. If you think the music business is slow, Hollywood's like a, you know, it's excruciating in terms of waiting around for stuff to come out. But anyway, we had a conversation about that movie and I was wanting to use some of his daddy's music in the soundtrack. And that's how I started making records with him because I was supposed to make an album at Sunset Sound in old downtown Hollywood, a famous old studio that I'd heard about because Bill Withers cut in there his debut album. And when I got it there with Shooter, because of what, you know, the Jennings family, Waylon's David and Goliath struggle, as he called it, against the studio systems and what was, I think, a draconian style music business practices in Nashville of that era. That's something like, you know, if you're in the Nelson family or the Jennings family, that's just in the DNA of the folks it's handed down to. And then Shooter, I think, did his first record deal with a very difficult Nashville system back in 2004, which as much as my struggles have been difficult, I can't imagine signing deals with those boys in Nashville in 2004. It was a tough time. And Shooter's come out of that the other side. And I think where he and I are really similar is that we both are artists who have had to learn the business in order to survive. And I had signed my deal with Island Records, which a lot of people that I was working with said, Charlie went to the majors because they made him, they gave him an advance he couldn't refuse. And that's not really true. It wasn't about the money at all. It was about creative and release control. The same thing that people like Willie and Waylon and Ray Charles, long before that, were all fighting for. And as soon as we got in the studio, I'd had some experience in big studios where I don't think I would have, you know, I was so intimidated when I was younger at the idea of all the money going into making a record and being in those studios with the producers, with the name and everything, with the label and the singles. And, you know, if it doesn't immediately start running, they just moved on to something else. So I needed to get all that experience under my belt before I really felt comfortable in a big fancy studio. And like I said, the only reason I went to big studios is because I was cutting with so many guys live. I just needed the space. And how it turned into a trilogy, could cut all that out when you start right here. How it became a trilogy actually was Justin Eshak, who runs Island Records. He knew that I was going to want to put out a lot of music. That was the only thing I was really talking about when all the different, you know, folks were calling with deals coming over the phone, is I really just cared about being able to release a lot of music. And Justin said, you should do something like the Cormac McCarthy Border Trilogy. And as soon as he came up with that idea, I saw that was my window to release a lot of music. And I had been influenced by everything from the original Star Wars trilogy, which is amazing, to Cormac McCarthy Border Trilogy, which I was familiar with. The Italian-made Westerns that really revolutionized the idea of American Westerns in a revisionist and realist way. Sergio Leone's Dollar Trilogy, you know, with the most famous being The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's really where it came from, and trying to kind of paint that picture and put all that together. And I hope I can have the kind of success that, you know, George Lucas and Sergio Leone had.
Well, you have a, there's a very cinematic vibe to the songs on here. I mean, you definitely, you have like a Morricone-esque song on here talking about spaghetti westerns. You also have a lot of strings. There's a lot of strings on the record, so I can understand why you needed that big space. Your musical taste is kind of all over the map, but it does cohesively fit. That's why I thought it was funny when you were like, is that country enough for you? When you were in the studio just now, because you're not just a country musician, although, you know, I'm hearing you talk, obviously. You're wearing a cowboy hat and the cowboy boots, but there's a lot more that goes into your music than just strictly country music, right?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a hotly debated subject out there in this nation.
People want to box you into one thing, but that's not really fair. No one is any one thing.
It's not fair to anybody. But at the same time, I remember when I was playing on the street here in New York, and there was a gal I knew, a Scottish gal, who was playing at open mics and playing out on the street with us and all that. And she had gone back over to Scotland, and she'd ended up on one of those talent shows over there where it had like more saturation in Europe than we have in our talent shows here by comparison. So she kind of became a star overnight at the time. And she'd come back over here to New York City, and I was still hoboing around and coming in out of New York. And I remember her talking to me about this very same thing, all the different styles that I was bringing together that a lot of artists, I think, do. And then, you know, the classifications come, which I'm proud of American music, but I hate to feel constricted by its conventions, right? But what I remember her telling me, she said, you're going to be in for a long battle because people, if they can't easily pigeonhole what you're doing, they can see you as complicated and that can be difficult. And she did predict the next dozen years or so for me, which was showing up on the map largely because of the massive renaissance in Nashville that is still continuing. I remember there was an exodus of songwriters out of the open mics and guitar pools around the villages here in the city back in, say, 2009, 10, 11, when I was on the street. Even back then, the songwriters were already packing up and going down to Nashville. And if you can believe it, that wave never slowed down. Austin's grown a lot in that time, right? But we don't have the music business on the level of New York, LA, or Nashville. And we've seen a big slowdown. I just come up here from Nashville, and I can assure you, it's not slowing down. You know, you go down there to Broadway, and you feel like you're looking at the Roman Coliseum or something, as my friend Marcus K. Dallin called it. And here's what I think. I think that my favorite artists of any background are the ones that take something very old in our storied, complicated American traditions, bring it to the front and do something new with it. I have said this about country music over and over. When I hear country music, it's like a like all of my favorite like Creole dishes where there's all these great flavors that are getting cooked down into this amazing sauce, you know, like a crawfish etouffee, you know, like in a dark roux sauce, or some people like the blonde flavored one or whatever. But even like George Jones, who maybe a lot of young people never even heard of, or Merle Haggard, you know, with his West Coast sound. I was listening to a lot of his records just the other day, and he has a lot of songs where if you remove the vocals and you just listen to the rhythm section, you could bring in the Supremes to sing over that very same beat. So a lot of it's identity based. And the classifications, as you step out further and further into the American public, they're a mirror. And the more people that you reach, the more that collectively the American people kind of, in some ways, show you who you are to them. It's like how I say, yeah, I might have written the song, but once somebody listens to it, in a way, it's as much theirs as it is mine.
Charlie, thank you so much for coming into Studio A. I like how layered these songs are. There's a lot to discover in them, and I think it does reward multiple listens. And I cannot wait to get my hands on the third installment of this trilogy. Do you have any ideas that you can share with us on what we can expect for the third?
You know, it is a trilogy. And so what I do know about part three is it should complete the
theme.
Yeah, it should complete the theme.
Can you talk a little bit about the theme? What do you see as the through line in this trilogy?
Well, you know, I called it Lonesome Drifter, the first one, as obviously with my life, you know, there's the old traditional song, Wayfaring Stranger. That's a standard in the idea of traditional old time music, folk music, bluegrass, what have you. And I was imagining this fictional character who is coming in from the wilderness, weary and hardened by the road, the only road. In Dollar a Day, with the title track, it's like he comes into contact with what I was kind of describing as the Santa Fe Ring, which you could look up. It was kind of a loose syndicate of power brokers in the New Mexico territory. in the days of Destiny Manifest and everything that comes along with that. So that's really kind of been the theme, is the dollar a day story is, because somebody tell me what's going on, stuck in the saddle from the first light of dawn. You know, I think the cowboy theme and why it's so evergreen, and the idea of this American idea, is I think it's connected with, you know, rugged individualism, which people have different opinions on why that comes to be. But when I was like over in London, they were asking me a lot about American themes of cowboy music. What I was saying that I would like to say to you is that I think that it's like the African-American struggle. I think one of the reasons that it resonates so constantly in American popular culture is because the perseverance of the African-American struggle is something that I think is the American identity. And I would say that if that was a coin, the other side of that coin, if we're really simplifying it to being dualistic about it, the other side of that coin is this idea of the rugged cowboy riding the bucking bronc, trying to hold on and stay on. The common theme, I guess, being that when I go around this country and play shows for people, as a cult figure from Austin, who I was lucky enough to know, would say, passed away last year, he'd say, "Charlie, there's too much month left at the end of the money." And I hope with Age of the Ram that I can...
FYI, Fordham University, you know, our mascot is the Rams.
You know, I got lost trying to find a bathroom and I saw all those Rams everywhere. See my belt buckle?
Yeah, I do.
I'm an Aries.
Nice. Oh, that makes sense.
You know, that's my zodiac. And I don't know, maybe my wife's right. Maybe our first allegiance is to the stars. I don't know.
Well, I am so glad to have this big star in front of me. And it's good that you brought up your wife, because you're going to end on a song that you co-wrote with your wife. It is called El Paso to Denver. And I really appreciate you bringing a little bit of Texas to New York City. Thank you so much, Charlie. And I love your new record. Congratulations.
Thank you, Elisa. You know, Texas is a native word. It means friends.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, thank you so much. And we will ride off into the sunset with this great live performance of El Paso to Denver from Charlie Crockett, live in Studio A.
El Paso to Denver, it's a mighty long road, but I'm still gonna go, 'cause you just never know what could be up there waiting in the Rocky Mountain High, like a good friend of mine. El Paso to Denver one more time. I'm out running men who just want me to change, while they stay the same, all stuck in their way. I find it ironic how I'm paying the price to chase long and white lines from El Paso to Denver one more time. Lock, stock, and teardrops got me well on my way. I've got bills to pay to stay in the game. I thought I heard wailing in the cool of the night, saying, "Boys, you'll be fine. El Paso to Denver one more time." You ain't been bought, then you're probably getting sold. They'll make you wanna fold. Greatest story ever told. I've been riding this country most all my life, like it's going out of style. From El Paso to Denver one more time. El Paso to Denver one more time. El Paso to Denver one more time.
I'm Charlie Crockett. That's Charlie with an EY, like Charlie Pride. Crockett with two T's, just like Davey. Thank y'all for having me.
That was Charlie Crockett performing and in conversation at WFUV in New York City. A big thank you to Charlie for joining us in our studio, and to Island Records. Thanks to our WFUV audio team, including Jim O'Hara and Aaron Merriman. Our FUV live studio sessions are engineered by Jim O'Hara. Our associate producer for this episode was Ina Volovich. Megan Suma is our executive producer. Our theme music was composed by John Crick. Be sure to follow FUV live sessions wherever you get your podcasts so you can listen to new episodes and find your next favorite artist or band. Episodes drop every Monday. Please rate and review the show if you like what you hear. You can also catch audio and video of FUV Live Sessions on WFUV.org. FUV Live Sessions is a production of WFUV in New York City. I'm your host, Alisa Ali.